Sluts and Scholars, a podcast for professionals who prioritize pleasure.
You are listening to a pleasure podcast. For more from our sex podcast collective, visit pleasurepodcasts.com.
Hey, listeners, you know, as Slutty Scholars here, we like to cover a wide range of important topics on this show. Just a heads up that this episode features a wonderful women's intimacy coach who is a former sex crimes deputy district attorney. We will touch on topics related to consent, sexual assault and rape, and the criminal justice system. As always, please take care however you need to, and we hope you enjoy the episode. And as a reminder, I am starting to do Q&A episodes and segments. If you want to ask a question that may be anonymously featured on the podcast, just go to sluttyscholars.com and click on Ask a Question, or go to the link in the show notes. I can't guarantee I will answer them all, but I look forward to hearing from you. You're also welcome to give feedback there, though I'd prefer you leave a 5-star written review. Now, on to the episode. Sluts and Scholars is a podcast produced by Sluts and Scholars Media, LLC. It is a shame-free educational podcast made for your entertainment and informational desires only. The podcast, any opinions we share, and any resources, including social media and emails from us, are not therapy, medical care, or professional advice, and do not create a patient-client relationship. None of the information, opinions, suggestions, resources, or exercises mentioned in this podcast should be used without clearance from your healthcare provider. All opinions, information, and ideas expressed by the guests are solely their own. If you need emergency mental health or medical help, please call 911 or 988 or go to your nearest emergency center. We hope you enjoy the show. Welcome back to another week of Sluts and Scholars, the podcast for professionals who prioritize pleasure. I'm Nicoletta Heidegger, and I'm a licensed marriage and family therapist and sexologist. And this week, I am welcoming Rena Martin. She is a women's intimacy coach, former sex crimes deputy district attorney for the Los Angeles County DA's office, and author of The Sex You Want, A Shameless Journey to Deep Intimacy, Honest Pleasure, and A Life You Love. Dun, 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 dun. Okay, I don't know how long I can do that before we get in trouble, makes me think of Law and Order. Welcome, Rena.
Hello, thanks for having me.
Okay, so listeners, I am doing something new by request. We are starting to incorporate your questions. Don't forget, you can ask anonymous questions in the link in my bio that can be or may be featured on the show. Remember that we are not your coaches, doctors, or therapists, but we hope that this will be educational for you. Are you ready for the question, Rena?
Oh, yes.
Okay, here is a question from one of our listeners who goes by Anonymous Steve. Okay. Hi. Where should I start after being in a monogamous relationship for so long? What are some ways to comfortably elaborate on the subject with my partner? Is there a questionnaire or booklet or something? Then they had sort of a sub question on what is the proper etiquette when asking others if they'd be interested in being a guest in our relationship, and how can we find therapists that are versed in these subjects? So questions. Do you want to start or should I start?
Yeah, I mean, okay. So just big picture, how do we start opening up the conversation?
Yeah.
What I say, you know, I teach a lot of classes on non-monogamy and I coach on non-monogamy too, is I say, you know, throw me under the bus. So
I say that too.
Right, Anonymous Steve. Hey, I was listening to this podcast today. You don't even need to say I was the one who submitted the question to the podcast.
Yeah, but some other guy named Steve.
Right. I was listening to a podcast today, and I was told that as homework for the listeners, that we're to go to our partners and say, hey, what are your views on monogamy? So that way it's, you know, this is something we're doing together and we're opening up this conversation together rather than this serious, you know, I've been thinking about our relationship structure. Mm. And so that's kind of my way of just opening up the broader conversation. There's a whole chapter in my book as far as, okay, and then where do we go from there with questions? But yeah. I would love to hear what first steps look like from you, Nicoletta.
Yeah, I mean, I think it depends if your partner is already on board and you're just like, well, how, now that we've both decided we're into it, like what next? I think if it's something that you've never really brought up before or you're not quite sure how to start, I also like to tell people to throw me under the bus or blame me, like, oh, I was reading this article, or oh, I heard this podcast. There's also some good apps out there like Couply or Lovewick, where you can
you know, they have sort of questions or decks of questions that have these types of questions in them about what are your feelings on non-monogamy. So you can start to see, like, is it a safer place to even talk about it? I also really like those, like, yes, no, maybe lists. And I also advocate for people to start scheduling, like, relational check-ins. Yes. And so even if you're not ready to maybe talk about the openness, to be able to, like, have a monthly, biweekly, quarterly check-in of, like, how are we feeling about our sex? How are we feeling about our relationship? What's working? What's not working? What's our current agreement? A lot of people have never figured out their agreement. So having more of those so that it can come up in, like, oh, we're already checking in, and kind of setting the stage that way. If I think it's something that you know you both are interested in, but you're wondering where to start, the good news is many have already paved the way, so you don't have to start fresh. There are so many books, podcasts, including on this show, including in your book, where you have questions that are prompted to you, where you can do book club together. Some of my favorites, let's say your book, Opening Up, Tristan Taormino, Open Deeply, Kate Lurie, Poly Secure, old school ones like Ethical Slut. There's lots that you can read, and read it together and then talk about it. Read it together, do the exercises, listen to the Multi-Amory podcast or read their book. Like, there's so much out there. So you have to consciously choose to make time for these conversations. So maybe the first step is, if you both know you're into it, be like, hey, how much time do we want to dedicate to working on this together?
Yeah. And also, I would encourage Anonymous Steve to really get clear on his own why, right? Why do you want this? Because I found that some people, I happen to be one of them, are wired for non-monogamy, or rather, we are not wired for monogamy. And some people are seeing this as a choice due to practical reasons. Mm-hmm. And if he falls into the latter category, and say his partner is not on board with non-monogamy, there could be a way, short of opening up the relationship, that those practical reasons could be met.
Yeah.
And so getting really clear on that first, before even trying to broach the subject, I always think is a good first step too.
Totally. And if you're curious to know, like, well, what are my actual reasons and what kind of non-monogamy am I interested in? I really like the course from Dr. Jana, who's a past guest, called Open Smarter. And it, like, helps people figure out, like, what style of relationship works best for them, including monogamy, but there's others as well. The second part of this question, Anonymous Steve asked about, like, proper etiquette for inviting someone in. So I'm guessing maybe there's already some openness happening. And my initial thought would be to see if there's some, either in real life, in-person events or online events, that you can attend to meet other like-minded people. So you can practice and discuss some of this stuff with other people who are into it, as opposed to approaching someone who's maybe not necessarily consenting to be approached for a threesome at a bar, which can happen. But there's dating apps for that now, like Field, where people are saying, hey, I am looking to be a third in this person's relationship. With that, I like to encourage people to make sure that they are checking themselves so that they're not unicorn hunting, which basically means that you are looking for a third person to just be an object to serve you and your partner, and essentially maybe treating them as lesser than. There may be some people who are into that, who want to just come in and be objectified, but you can still have respect and treat them as a, you know, as a esteemed guest. Yes.
A special guest star, as Dan Savage says.
Yes, a special guest star. And so, yeah, my invitation would be to start with apps and things where people are already looking to be a third, so that the approach is already out there of, like, hey, I'm looking for other people to connect with. And you also mentioned, how can you find a therapist? The good news is that, you know, there are so many therapists who specialize in sex therapy. And if you can't find a therapist in your area, in your state, in your city, there are coaches like Rena who do this in any part of the world, because therapists can only practice in the states they're licensed. And so one way to find a therapist is to go to the American Association of Sex Educators, Counselors, and Therapists website, find a database on there, make sure the person is sex positive, ask them about their, if they have training in non-monogamy. You can also use Psychology Today and use some of these keywords, but make sure they actually have training, not just that they're like, oh, I'm supportive of this, if you really want some guidance. But yeah, then there are coaches like Rena who specialize in opening up. So maybe consider getting a coach to help you and your partner navigate this.
Yeah, great advice. Great advice. You covered everything.
Oh my God, did I therapist it and not let you respond to any of it?
No. I'm like, nope. She mentioned Field. There's also Cassidy.com, which is kind of like in the same way that FetLife is Facebook for kinky people, Cassidy is basically Facebook for people in the lifestyle. So that could be another resource too, as far as finding events. If you lean kinky, FetLife, go to the events section there. But yeah, there's so many resources now to help you find your people so that you aren't the unicorn hunters at the bar approaching single individuals and creeping them out and objectifying people. Do not be that person. Do not be that couple. Please, please. And also, because people have been asking me my thoughts on Couple to Thruple. I don't know if you've seen it, Nicoletta.
Oh, I haven't watched it yet. I definitely think the educator is doing her best. I think she's going to come on the podcast soon, but I'd love to hear your thoughts on it. I haven't watched it yet.
Yeah, so I won't give any spoilers, but to the person posing the question, don't take advice on how to handle this from watching the couples on that show.
Oh my God, please say more. It's okay if you ruin it a little bit. Spoiler alert, turn this part off if you don't want any spoilers.
Oh my gosh, especially in the first few episodes, the way that the prospective thirds are being treated was, you know, this objectification, commodification, and somewhat inhumanely, even by the couples who were really well-meaning. And it really broke my heart. And this is yet another example of the lack of positive, accurate depictions that we have in mainstream media when it comes to non-monogamy. And it's like, okay, great, more people are talking about it, but when are we going to get some healthy examples of this?
Yes.
And sadly, yeah, I don't know that more show is.
Yeah, it just adds more to like that this isn't workable or is problematic or, you know.
Yeah.
Is there an example out there that you have seen in mainstream-ish media that was like, all right?
The fact that I have to think this.
I know, I'm thinking too, and I can't.
No.
Okay, if you listeners know of a good one, email it to sludsandscholars@gmail.com or comment on one of our posts or DM it. Because I mean,
there was Jules and Jim from the 60s, you know, a fictionalized account of a woman and like her two lovers, basically. Like, I think it's Truffaut who directed it. But I mean, that's just a fun kind of movie. As far as mainstream reality, I mean, I don't know if you saw There's No I in Threesome, which was kind of documentary-ish, and that did not have a happy ending. We're just not seeing a lot of good examples. And Couple to Thruple, I think, could have been had they selected couples who were at least somewhat experienced in non-monogamy.
Yeah, it sounds like these people haven't really maybe done their own therapy work to manage some of the stuff coming up.
Right. So I can't wait to hear the conversation you're going to have with the expert from that show. Because agreed, she did the best she possibly could have with that format and that structure.
Yeah. Oh, that's so rough. I know. I'm always watching like Love is Blind, or we used to have like a queer women's like bachelor viewing party, which was just like our way of like watching trash TV and trying to not feel so horrible that we were watching it. like this is a feminist viewing of The Bachelor, but like,
right.
We so many of the issues can be solved on these by like being non-monogamous.
Yeah.
Like, I'm really waiting for the day when they have reality shows of the dating kind where you don't have to choose one person.
I know, right?
Yeah.
And I watch a lot of the dating shows for science, obviously.
Yes, because for science.
Because of what I do for work.
Yeah, for an analytical lens, obviously.
Of course. But it is fascinating to me because sometimes, and I don't know if you feel the same way, but amongst the social circles I have now, my professional circles, it can feel like people are a lot more open-minded about things. And when I watch some of the more mainstream shows like Love is Blind, I get this snapshot of what's actually going on in the dating world.
Yeah.
And oof.
Yeah. They need therapists and coaches on those shows. I don't know if they have people behind the scenes, but please hire us for your dating shows.
Please.
They need help.
Please.
I feel like they're not hiring us because they don't want us to minimize the drama.
I know, because that doesn't make for good TV, right?
Well, that's not true. People really like watching couples therapy and stuff like that.
That's true. Yeah. That's true.
Okay, well, thank you, Anonymous Steve, for submitting your question. Hopefully this helps you get started and find some support. Let us know. Okay, Rena, back to you. So hard, right? Today, I'd really love to focus on a couple of the topics that you talked about in your book. And you have some chapters that discuss fantasies. And one, because of the work that you used to do that I'd really like to focus on today is force and submission fantasies.
Yeah.
Especially since you are a sex crimes DA. So yeah, in your book, you talk about this. And I've heard you say that a recent study shows that up to 93% of women identifying people have had sexual submission fantasies. But for a lot of the folks that have these, it can feel psychologically troubling to them if they feel like an empowered woman. And I know in your book, you help people kind of reconcile this. So I'd love to chat with you about it today. So when we say submission fantasy, mm-hmm. what does that even mean?
I mean, it's going to be a spectrum, right? It can right. run the gamut from I am in a 24/7 dom sub relationship and I don't do anything without my dom's permission or instruction to, hey, put a blindfold on me and just take control. Mm-hmm. So submission is just any situation where you have some control, whether that be decision-making control. And I'm going to put that in air quotes, decision-making, because all of this is done consensually. Decision-making or in terms of your senses or your freedom of movement. Mm-hmm. That some of what goes on during the play or during the scene, you don't have to think about. And that's really where the correlation is between our increase in fantasizing about these types of things, these fantasies in terms of giving up control. If we think about our fantasies being a window into what our actual emotional needs are, mm-hmm. we're finding that folks who identify as women now, more so than any other time in human history, we're having to make more decisions outside of the bedroom on a day-to-day basis. Mm-hmm. As partners, perhaps as moms, perhaps as, you know, employees or CEOs. I mean, all of these decisions. And so there is this increasing desire to, oh my gosh, can somebody else just make this decision for me? Can yes. my job be just to exist in this space and be told what to do? Or do I have to micromanage this part of my life too? Mm-hmm.
Yeah. I mean, that's exactly how I feel when I get home from like supporting clients all day, you know, friends, partner, whatever, ask me like, well, what do you want to watch? What do you want to eat? And I'm like, somebody else, please.
Yes. Use
their brain because mine is tired.
Yeah.
Do you put this into the same category or different category as like force fantasies? So when I say force fantasies, I mean, we're playing with consensual non-consent, which is right. like I'm being quote unquote forced to do this. It's a type of submission.
Yeah. Yeah. So the numbers on that are a bit lower. So if we're talking about just general submission, that's about 93% of okay. folks, of female identifying folks. And when it comes to forced seduction, that number, I think it's either 53 or 56%. Mm-hmm. If you want to get the exact number, Justin J. Lay Miller's book, Tell Me What You Want. He's yes. the world's expert on this. So fantastic.
Yeah. He's been on the show. Go back and listen to it.
Oh my gosh, I just adore him and the work he's doing in the world. Mm. But the forced seduction fantasies, and I'm going to throw this in big old air quotes because people will call these rape fantasies.
Yeah.
They're not rape fantasies. So let me just like start off there because what we're talking about isn't a rape. It's not a sexual assault. The average person, if we're walking alone in a scary alleyway at night, we're not actually fantasizing about a stranger coming out and sexually assaulting us. What we're talking about here is that we are playing, we are pretending to give up control. And so in terms of these forced seduction fantasies, what is the underlying emotional need? Part of it could be, oh my gosh, just make the decision. Part of it could also be, oh my gosh, I love this idea of pretending like I am so irresistible to you, mm-hmm. that you are just so overcome with desire for me that you're just going to take me and, you know, ravage me kind of thing. So these types of fantasies, though, can be particularly troubling for people who have survived sexual trauma, though, because it's like, well, why am I fantasizing about the thing that hurt me so badly? Mm-hmm. And if we think about the way our brain works when it comes to trauma, that we can't think our way through trauma, we have to introduce opposite action. And what your brain is doing here by fantasizing about something similar to what actually traumatized you in the first place is it's giving you an opportunity to what's known as restage the trauma. So in essence, you're saying, all right, I want to do this over again, but this time it's my decision instead of something that was done to me. I am in the director's chair this time. I am the one asking for this type of play. I know that at any point I can yell cut, and it's done. I know that I'm going to be cared for after mm-hmm. the fact. I know that I get my control back once the scene ends. Yeah. And so if you understand it in that context, it can feel a lot less scary or pathological or shameful. Like, oh my God, what is wrong with me that I'm fantasizing
right.
about this type of thing? So I like to put that out there because when I've taught classes on sexual fantasies, mm-hmm. inevitably I have somebody, you know, kind of anonymously in the Zoom chat sending me a question, hey, can you talk about rape fantasies?
Yeah.
Because more than half of folks have had them, but we're not really having honest conversations about what they are, what they mean, and that they're actually pretty normal.
Totally. Yeah. And especially for survivors, as you said, who want to have like a corrective, reclaiming experience with it. I remember when I did a paper on like forced fantasies back in grad school, another like reason that research was showing that so many people have them is especially for folks who experience shame around sexuality, that it was sort of a way to be like, well, it's not my desire. This person yeah. made me do it. And so there's also this like aspect of, yeah, it's not my choice. So therefore it's not my fault. In the fantasy. And so someone else is sort of taking ownership over this thing that a person might not feel, you know, that is okay for them to do.
Yeah. Yeah. And I mean, there's so many reasons why one might choose to engage in this. And I love yeah. that too, that you're essentially allowing someone to, in a way, give you permission to enjoy something that you feel yeah. for a variety of reasons you're not supposed to enjoy.
Yeah. Not that you need permission, but I think obviously we live in a culture where there's a lot of shaming of especially women who like have desire and things like that. So, you know, that's why a lot of people have that fantasy. But I also want to highlight something that you said is like submitting or in these fantasies, the person is giving away their control, right? Yeah. So it's like you have it and you're choosing to transfer that power to somebody else versus mm-hmm. in a real life situation, someone is taking it from you.
Yeah.
So when we
yeah,
say
and
submission,
then you get it back.
Yeah, yeah. And so when we say submission, can you help kind of clarify for folks, like, what does that really mean about who's in power?
You know, I've gotten into a little bit of trouble on TikTok for this, but anyway, we don't need to go into why I don't like TikTok.
Okay.
But, you know, I did a video a while ago that was me saying, look, ultimately, the sub is the one who holds the most control in any kind of DS dynamic, because they're the ones who ultimately are going to decide what is allowed and what the hard limits are. And a lot of people started getting at me like, no, well, the DOMs, you're making it seem like DOMs don't have control either. I went, yes, of course. DOMs can absolutely fill in the lines. Like, you know, the DOM, the sub is like, all right, I'm giving this kind of a coloring book, the outlines here of what I'm okay with.
Yeah.
But you can obviously change your mind about it anytime. But then, you yeah. know, the DOM can kind of choose how to color those in. And so when it comes to
well, you're controlling, deciding if you want to give up your control.
Yes, exactly. Exactly.
And in a scene yeah. or in a life or in right. in a relationship.
Right. And I mean, there's plenty of scenarios where we do that in our day-to-day lives. Like you go out to a restaurant, you are giving somebody else the power to control the food that you're about to consume and put into your body.
So right? All you restaurant eaters, you're kinky as fuck, just letting you know.
Yeah, but if you go and you order a burger and they come out with tacos, like that's not what you signed up for.
Yeah, you can choose to do the omakase, like chef, give me whatever you want, or you can micromanage your food, which I do because I want the sauces that I want.
It's all about the sauces, right?
It's all about the sauce. I'm a total sauce slut. Yeah. Oh my God. We give up control in so many places. Like I'm just thinking I'm going to like a thing at Six Flags in a couple of days and like giving up control to these teenagers who probably shouldn't be operating roller coasters, but I'm giving them my life basically.
Well, I saw this meme that was like, you know, 20 years ago, don't talk to strangers on the internet and don't get into a stranger's car. And then it's like, we use Lyft and Uber and we're doing the exact things that our moms and our parents told us not to do.
Totally.
And so we give up control in a lot of ways without even thinking about it. So this is just a different way of doing that.
This episode is sponsored by Osea, skincare from the sea. All of you slutty mermaids can get 10% off now with discount code SCHOLARS10. Just go to the link in the episode description or go to sluttyscholars.com and click on the OCL link and enter code SCHOLARS10 for 10% off. If you've listened to the show before, y'all know I already love the vagus nerve body oil from Osea. I use it in my bath, and I also have the pillow spray, which I use nightly. But let me tell you a little bit about Osea. They are a mother-daughter founded, clinically proven skincare brand from the sea. Their signature ingredient, Undaria algae, is a brown algae that is rich in awesome nutrients like sodium, iron, potassium, calcium, and vitamins B1, B2, B3, B6, and B12. I personally really like the Undaria algae body oil, which is clinically proven to instantly improve skin elasticity and deliver deep moisturization. I put it on right when I get out of the shower, and y'all know I am all about pleasure rituals, so I make a self-love ritual out of it, and I say affirmations while I put the luxurious oil on. It's a whole decadent experience. You can get 10% off now with discount code SCHOLARS10. Just go to the link in the episode description or go to sluttyscholars.com and click on the Osea link and enter code SCHOLARS10 for 10% off. Now back to the episode.
When you were a DA, did you know about this, or is this something you've transitioned into? Because I was just interviewing somebody who's a lawyer talking about just how like not trauma and sex informed most of the legal system is. So how did you learn about this? And was it something you incorporated when you were in that line of work?
Yeah, I can't say that I had a lot of cases where this was, say, like a defense, for example, because you'll see that like, no, it was just rough sex. Mm. So I didn't have cases like that that came to trial where I'd have to bring in an expert to talk about this kind of thing. I began learning about this in my own personal life because I'd always had an interest in not necessarily the pain aspect of BDSM, but the surrendering control aspect. Yeah. Like I, you know, Belle de Jour is one of my favorite movies. And I liked Secretary when it came out.
Four P's.
Yes, four P's. So
if you know, you know.
Yes, exactly. And of course, I can get into why, you know, that movie's somewhat problematic and how we don't have a lot of good mainstream depictions of people just being kinky and not because they are abuse survivors. I mean, 50 Shades is another example of that. But I knew that there was something stirring in me, but I didn't necessarily have the words to put to that. And it wasn't until I met my my now primary partner, who has quite a bit of experience as a dom, that he was like, I understand what you're saying. And so that's been just eye-opening to me. And I kind of realized like, whoa, this was the missing part of my life. But I wouldn't say that kink and negotiated power exchange was a huge part of the work I did as a sex crimes prosecutor.
Yeah. I mean, I'm curious, like, what, I'm sure you've answered this before, but like what shifted you away from that work?
Well, about a decade in, so I was a prosecutor for 14 years.
Yeah.
And about a decade in, I hit my breaking point because juries just do weird things in sex cases.
Because of their own like issues around the topic?
Yes. Yes. And so for example, if you have a case where it's like a DNA cold hit. So perpetrator and victim are unknown to each other. And we find this person, and this is like an anonymous person, stranger attack, which, as we know, is very uncommon when we're looking at sexual assault. But in those cases, juries would love to convict because it reinforces this idea that there's that this like boogeyman. You know. Exactly. That there's this boogeyman out there. But in cases where it's, you know, a coach at school, a religious figure, a step parent, a family member, a partner, juries would go out of their way to do mental gymnastics to find a way not to convict. Because if they are to say, yes, this exists in the world, that really undermines their own sense of safety in the world. They have to worry about, oh my gosh, is every time I leave my kid with a pastor or with a coach or with my spouse or with a family member, is there a chance that this might happen?
Yeah.
And so I had seen this, you know, for a decade, how this played out in real time. And I hit my breaking point when I was prosecuting a case, which was a very strong case. We had two minors who did not know each other, who had both been abused by the same person. I will spare all the gory details, but strong case. And the jury could not reach a verdict. So they hung on the more serious counts. And I spoke to the jury foreperson after they came back and they said, we can't reach a verdict because jurors are told, hey, if you're willing to talk to the lawyers, stick around. So I spoke to the jury foreperson who I knew from voir dire was the head of a nonprofit that serves underprivileged youth. And I said to him, you know, what happened back there? And he said, I work with these kids on a daily basis and these kids lie. And what I understood that to mean was non-white children from, you know, not financially well-off families, perhaps. But hearing that, and the same week that this was going on, Me Too was just starting to gain momentum. Louis C.K. had his entire tour canceled. Mm. So seeing this kind of disparity in who gets justice and why, and really how fundamentally broken the system was at that time, I think that we're seeing a change in tide here. Like if we look at the first Bill Cosby trial and then the second one post Me Too, I think things are shifting. But at the time I said, I'm checking out of this system because I cannot stand to tell another family, hey, these members of your community just don't believe your child or didn't believe your child. Mm. And that was really hard. So I transitioned into prosecuting other kinds of cases within the DA's office. So for a time I was in our justice system integrity division. So we would go after law enforcement who were committing crimes. I was then in our habeas litigation division for a bit. But the job just became a job. And I didn't feel like I was necessarily making a change in the world. And that's when it became clear that so much of what I'm here to do on this planet is to help people. And at the same time, I was going through my own journey of sexual shame and therapy and reading all the books and listening to all the podcasts. And I thought, what if there's a way that I could help women do what my therapist helped me do, but in a much shorter period of time? Mm-hmm. And that's ultimately what led me to transition out of the law and into now working with people one-on-one as a coach.
Yeah. Oh, that's amazing. Thank you for sharing your journey. It sounds like an intense job. And I can imagine a lot of burnout rate for folks in that space.
Yeah.
Like with a therapist as well, but just seeing so much. And I'm curious, like, were you able to have pleasure times when you were working in that space? And I ask as like a therapist, because I think a lot of people assume like, oh, you're a sex therapist. You must be having sex all kinds of ways all the time. And like, probably compared to the other person, I am doing a lot more adventurous things than folks, you know, who may not know about this stuff. And when you work in something, hearing about trauma and stuff all day, like Emily Nagoski talks about in her new book, Come Together, it may make you not want to have sex. So I'm curious, like, was pleasure present in your life when you were working that kind of stuff?
Not as much. And I don't know whether that's correlation or causation there. And based on kind of the personal stifling and shame I felt in my own sense of sexuality in my relationships at the time.
Yeah.
But I can echo.
And for people who don't know what that is, there's correlation or causation in research. It's like sometimes people will make claims that research says that something like causes something else, but a correlation doesn't mean that one variable is causing another. So for example, with like sex and porn, there have been some research that show that there's a correlation between people who aren't happy in their relationship and are watching porn. Conservative people will say, oh, well, porn causes bad relationships, as opposed to, no, we don't know that. You may be watching more porn because you're not happy in your relationship. So that's correlation causation.
Or I think like a common one is that when ice cream consumption rates go up, then sexual assault rates go up. And that's correlation. Well, because, you know, sexual assault rates and ice cream consumption both go up during warmer months. That's correlation. That is not causation. There's no link between ice cream and sexual assault, right?
But thank you for clarifying that. Yeah. Nobody eat ice cream.
So it's hard for me to say, but interestingly, you know, going back to what you were talking about in terms of the average person assuming that because of the work you do, because of the work I do, that we're just like having balls to the wall sex all the time. It's tricky because, you know, for me at least, if I'm like at a play party, for example, now I find that the work part of my brain is more active than the play part of my brain. And so it's been kind of tricky. Like filmmakers will say, you know, or like magicians, right? Once you learn how to do magic, you can never enjoy magic again because you know how the magic is done type of thing. And it's not a one-to-one comparison, but I feel like because now this is my life's work, I have to be very mindful of, okay, don't engage that work fixer part of the brain. Like you're here to have fun and this isn't about other people's fun. This is just, you know, this is about your own pleasure. So I don't know. If you can relate to that at all.
Totally. Just going back for a second to the work that you were doing in the DA's office, do you feel like there are changes being made? And I wonder now that you are like sex educator, are you recalling just like all the wrong ways that people got sex stuff back in those trials, that like just such misunderstanding and lack of knowledge about sexuality and trauma? It's not trauma informed at all.
Yeah. I mean, luckily, you know, working in LA County, we had our fair share of experts that we could bring in when it comes to delayed reporting, for example, meaning you were a victim of a sex crime and you waited a long time to report.
Right.
Really good domestic violence experts, things like that. But I remember a case I was doing with it was a rape case, really brutal rape case. And the defense attorney, a man with three children, and this is relevant for a reason, three daughters. And I had asked the judge to give the jury an instruction differentiating between labia minora and labia majora, because under the law, you have to show penetration of either finger, penis, or object into the vagina. And one of the allegations was, you know, there was penetration of the labia, but not into the vagina. So I asked the judge, hey, can you instruct the jury that it's any penetration, however slight, and that it can just be the labia, so the outside part, it doesn't have to go all the way in. And this attorney who has three daughters was like, majora, minora, what's the difference here? And so I had to educate the jury, like, imagine the vulva is like an ear and there's this part of the ear and then there's the canal and you know, and doing some of that base level education there.
Yeah.
But I, you know, so much has changed since I stopped prosecuting sex crimes.
Yeah.
Like, you know, I've had former colleagues of mine reach out, hey, my husband and I, we want to design a sex room. Can you help me? I've had judges who I'm still friends with reach out. Okay, I need to buy a new sex toy.
Yes.
And so, right? So I don't necessarily know which way the pendulum is swinging, but I think it's swinging in a sex positive direction at this point.
At least in Los Angeles.
Yes. Well, yeah, exactly.
So going back to this kind of submission fantasy, I want people to read your book, and I know they can also hire you, but like for folks who maybe are listening who have shame about some of these fantasies and desires, where can people start to accept that it's okay to be a feminist, be empowered, all these things, and still enjoy this fantasy? Like, how do we start?
Well, I think big picture here is to understand that it's probably precisely because you are a feminist and precisely because you are empowered that this fantasy appeals to you. If you want to nerd out on all the science, you know, I'll bring up Justin Leigh Miller's book again.
Tell
me what you want.
We're slutty scholars here.
Right. But like, if you want to really dig into all the science and the facts and the numbers there, his book is a great starting point. But big picture, if we can understand that the taboo arouses us, if we look at differences in fantasies, for example, between self-identified conservatives and self-identified liberals, like conservatives are more likely to have non-monogamy fantasies. They're more likely to have cuckolding fantasies, meaning I want to see my female spouse with another man. And why is that? Well, because those are more taboo based on their underlying belief systems. Whereas self-identified liberal or progressive folks tend to fantasize more about power imbalances because that in and of itself is more transgressive to what their underlying beliefs are about egalitarianism and gender equality in the world. So I think regardless of whether you're having submission fantasies and you're a feminist and empowered, or you're having any fantasy that's troubling you, if you can get curious as to, okay, what emotional need could this be meeting? Is it that, oh my gosh, I just want somebody else to take over and make some of those decisions for me because I'm making too many damn decisions during the day-to-day? Or is it like, oh, there's something about this that's really taboo and the taboo inherently turns us on? What is that? Approaching this from a place of curiosity instead of judgment is the place to start. And then if you want to dive super deep into the research, Justin Leigh Miller's book is a great resource for that too. And his Sex and Psychology podcast. But I think that big picture is really, regardless of what your fantasy is, the best place to start.
Yeah. And I think it's also, sorry, I lost my train of thought for a second. Hopefully it'll come back to me. I hate when that happens. Oh, I think it's also an important way when, so that we're not just repeating our trauma patterns, because I do think there are some people have this sort of, what did you call it? Like restaging.
Yes.
Something that has been traumatic for them. And so they are able to have this sort of corrective healing experience and redo it, re-narrate it. And there are other people who unconsciously repeat their trauma through their sexual behaviors, which can just be re-traumatizing. And so I think what you're saying to me is really the key to go from like having it be a potentially harmful experience to having it be a potentially healing, restorative experience is the intention, is the knowledge, is the admission of like, here's what this interests about me, here's why I'm into this. Even if it's not, some people are into this and they haven't had trauma, obviously. But for the folks who maybe are re-narrating it, it's like, okay, I'm aware that this is why I have an interest. I'm aware of what interests me about it, so that they can be intentional about their exploration and not just like dissociatingly redoing it over and over.
Right. And basically not pathologizing why they have this, because we don't pick our fantasies. And if we try to suppress them, they become psychological preoccupations, which is really bad for us. Yeah. So in terms of restaging, you know, there's a chapter in my book called Give Your Trauma a Home. And I give a variety of examples of what people's trauma and triggers look like and how we restaged it, because every person's trauma, every person's triggers are going to be unique to them. But generally speaking, you take away the X factor that made it dangerous in the first place. So, you know, I had a situation in the last few years where I was traumatized during a BDSM scene with somebody who's not a partner of mine. And for about a month, I couldn't engage in any sort of DS play without becoming triggered. And I know the tools, right? Like, this is exactly what I help folks do. And so I thought, okay, we did some trial and error. And eventually I said, let's take an EDS off the table and it'll be my decision when I want to bring that back in. So even though I'm sub, I'm the one who's going to decide. And that was what helped me restage that, right? So it's going to be unique for every person. Again, because you do run the risk of perhaps re-traumatizing if you're not doing this correctly. But if you understand how trauma works, how our fantasies work, and how restaging works, you can absolutely fine-tune this in a way where it's not going to have to take you years to work through something so that you can start reclaiming pleasure in your life.
Yeah. Any examples of, you know, in an anonymous way, folks that you've either worked with as coaching clients or folks that you know of like what this has actually looked like in practice for them?
For sure. So I had one client who had been in a sexually abusive relationship for a number of years with the father of her child. And that relationship ended. She was dating this great new guy. And she came to me and said, I think I need help because every time I try to have sex with my new partner, I start shaking and I cry and I shut down. So we got curious about that. I said, okay, well, give me an example of what specifically is happening right before you break down. And she said, well, it happens when he starts undressing me or when I'm in missionary position. So when I'm on my back, because that's typically how her ex would abuse her. And he'd force her to take off her clothes and he'd put her on her back and then sexually assault her. He would rape her. So I said, all right, how about for the time being, and this new person she was dating was aware of her traumatic history. How about for the time being, you ask if you're the one to take your own clothes off and that you both take missionary off the table. And so she did that. And it took about 2 weeks. And then she was requesting missionary. And then she was requesting that, you know, hey, I would like for you to take my clothes off.
Yeah.
So that's an example of restaging. I have one client who survived repeated adolescent sexual trauma by a sports coach. So an athletic coach, she was a child athlete.
Yeah.
To the point where any sort of touch on certain parts of her body, she would shut down. So as a result, she wasn't dating. She wasn't really engaged in any sort of sexual activity. And she's like, I don't want to do that anymore. And she ended up getting really curious about BDSM, started taking some Shibari workshops where she was paying for somebody to tie her up. So, you know, knowing that she was in control here, she was willingly giving up that control. This wasn't someone who she was going to be sexually intimate with. And she began leaning into it in that way. And then eventually she started in her own personal life, you know, she went on Field, she went on FetLife and started dating with a DS dynamic there where she's like, hey, there was a power differential when my coach was abusing me as a kid. And that's a power differential that I had no control over. But here, we've negotiated it. And that's the difference. It's taking away the X factor that made it dangerous in the first place. And obviously, I could go on and on and list a lot more examples.
Yeah.
But it's restaging. You're taking the story and you're telling it a little bit differently.
But it's helpful to hear them to get people's creative minds going of like,
exactly. Exactly. And I give about, I think, 5 or 6 different examples of that in that specific chapter in my book by way of illustration so that people can see, oh, okay, I think I get it now.
Yeah. I mean, what are you hoping people take away from your book?
Oh my gosh. Well, one, that we all deserve great sex, but that really, you know, intimacy and closeness with people, it isn't just sex. Mm-hmm. That we deserve to feel secure in our bodies. We deserve to have a loving relationship with ourselves. We deserve to have close and deep, intimate relationships with other people. And we deserve to have great sex too. So,
how you called that in your title of like a life you love, right?
Yeah.
Because there's so many ways to have connection and intimacy and pleasure. And it doesn't have to be this hierarchical that it has to be with sex or with a romantic partner.
Yeah. Yeah. And the way my book is structured is part one is building a healthy relationship with you. Part two is how to have healthier relationships with other people. And we don't even really dive into sex that much until part three, because I can give you tips and tricks and, okay, here are some blowjob tips or buy this toy. I mean, whatever. But if you don't feel safe in your own body, those are just band-aids, right? So we have to build a solid foundation, and it's figuring out a life you love, the kind of relationship you want, if you do want one, the kind of sex you want, instead of giving this, you know, kind of cookie cutter template for people, but giving you tools to get curious about what makes you, you.
Totally. Well, I definitely want people to buy your book. And before we wrap, I know before you and I started this interview, we were just talking a little bit about payment processors. And so as I encourage people to buy your book, I want to check in with you. Can you share with our listeners what happened recently with payment processing and how they are anti-sex educator?
Okay. So I use Stripe as the payment processor for my coaching. When I do consulting work with companies, some of my educational work, that's my invoicing platform. That's where, you know, the credit cards get run.
Yeah.
I've been using them for years, and I get an email from them last week saying, just, you know, on March 22nd, we're going to shut down your account because you've been violating our rules as far as what's authorized use. And so I look at the
fine print. They didn't know they were fucking with a lawyer.
Oh, yeah, no. And they're like, yeah, you're selling sex on the internet is basically what they accused me of doing. And look, I know plenty of sex workers out there, and I'm not, you know, but I'm not a sex worker and I'm not selling sex. And if I were, I'm sure as hell not stupid.
They should still be able to use payment processors too.
Right. And so just today, I had to submit a lot of documentation, and they fucked with a lawyer and now they're going to find out. So it's either going to backfire because they're like, I don't want to read through all of this, or, you know, they might just get overwhelmed and say, okay, fine. Just reinstate her account. But no, they wanted me to provide documentation that I am certified to provide sex coaching. And I said, look, I'm an intimacy coach. I'm a women's intimacy coach. I don't identify as a sex coach. And there is no certification for women's intimacy coach. It's kind of like being a lawyer. You get a law degree and then you decide where you want to specialize. And so I attached my life coaching certification, gave them all my credentials from when I used to be a DA. Here's some LA Times articles about cases I prosecuted as a sex crimes prosecutor, you know, letting them know I have a lengthy history of doing this. Hey, here's my TEDx talk I gave on this. Here's my book. Yes. So we'll see, TBD, but
keep us posted.
I will. And this was out of nowhere years later. So yes.
So frustrating. I'm sorry you had to go through that. You are not alone. And it's, they're coming for all of us, right? Like educators too. And this is one of the reasons why some of the anti-trafficking legislation has actually made things worse for consensual legal sex workers as well. From performers, you know, OnlyFans people, because payment processors won't work with them. And so they kind of push things into the shadows even more, which can make it more dangerous.
Right. I mean, it's kind of like abortions. Like, you're not outlawing abortion, you're outlawing safe abortion.
Exactly. Yeah. Well, this has been awesome chatting with you. I want people to check out your book. How can people find you, get in touch, hire you, all the things?
Yeah. So you can head on over to my Instagram. I'm at @rena.martin_, or my website, which is renamartin.com.
And listeners, if you want to follow what I'm doing, I'm on Instagram at Sluts and Scholars. You can listen anywhere you get your podcasts, or at slutsandscholars.com. And because of censorship, please make sure to subscribe, rate, review, join my newsletter on my website to make sure that if we lose our platforms, you can find me. Rena, thank you so much for joining and for the work that you do.
Thank you, Nicoletta.
Sluts and Scholars, a podcast for professionals who prioritize pleasure. Sluts and Scholars is a podcast produced by Sluts and Scholars Media, LLC. It is a shame-free educational podcast made for your entertainment and informational desires only. The podcast, any opinions we share, and any resources, including social media and emails from us, are not therapy, medical care, or professional advice, and do not create a patient-client relationship. None of the information, opinions, suggestions, resources, or exercises mentioned in this podcast should be used without clearance from your healthcare provider. All opinions, information, and ideas expressed by the guests are solely their own. If you need emergency mental health or medical help, please call 911 or 988 or go to your nearest emergency center. We hope you enjoy the show.